Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome to part one of our Mysteries and Monsters Halloween double bill. Today, our episode will focus on one of the most well-known haunted sites in America, a name famous the world over, Gettysburg. As the scene of the bloodiest battle of the American Civil War, Gettysburg is drenched in the blood of those who lost their lives over that three-day period in July 1863. Over 7,000 soldiers died during those 72 hours, and if one place on American soil holds on to the past, then Gettysburg is certainly that. Joining us to guide us around the ghosts and ghouls of Gettysburg is author, investigator and tour guide, Mark Nesbitt. What Mark doesn't know about the area probably isn't worth knowing. But before we join him, don't forget to follow us on all the social media platforms, subscribe to us on YouTube, and please leave us a nice review on your podcast aggregator. You can also support us on Patreon for $1 a month. Now, let's take a walk amongst the spirits still clinging on at Gettysburg. My guest on this Halloween special edition is Mark Nesbitt. Mark is a former National Park Service Ranger and historian, and he is the author of several books covering the ghosts of Gettysburg, and he has appeared on countless TV shows, podcasts and radio interviews. Mark, thank you so much for joining me today. How are we?
Just fine, Paul. My pleasure.
So, obviously I've seen you a few times on TV and heard you interviewed in the past, but how, I mean, obviously Gettysburg is a very emotive subject for a lot of people in the States. How did you, originally from the area and found yourself working, or was it something you gravitated towards earlier in your life, Mark?
Actually, I kind of got interested in Gettysburg when my parents took me there when I was about 7 or 8 years old. It was almost like a fluke because we were going somewhere else in Pennsylvania for our vacation that summer. And we ended up going to Gettysburg. And after that, I think I must have read a little children's book on the Battle of Gettysburg, because that got me very interested then. We continued to take vacations to Gettysburg. My parents were interested in the countryside and also the history. And then when I was the summer before my senior year in college, I applied for a job with the government there, with the National Park Service, and luckily got the job. So I spent the next 6 years or so working for the national park and learning all I could about Gettysburg and the sites, and also picking up strange stories about the town and the battlefield. So when I say strange, I mean literally ghost stories. So that's actually how it got started.
Yeah. So was it
whilst you were working there, I mean, obviously by this point, I think, are we talking about what, the 1970s when you were working there, Mark, or was it?
That is correct. Yeah, 1970s.
So, from my understanding, they'd already started to be quite a history of which essentially started near enough after the end of the Civil War, I imagine, that this area had a long history of people having supernatural experiences.
That is correct. I collected some stories from older park rangers, and some of them were, you know, predated the Civil War, back into the 1700s, as a matter of fact. And also some contemporary stories. One of the things that the park rangers do at Gettysburg is they live in the houses out on the battlefield that were there at the time of the battle.
Wow.
For security purposes, you know, because the park is closed after 10 o'clock at night. Mm. And so they station rangers. You get to live in the houses out there. And I lived in four different houses. And Paul, every one of them, I had something strange or weird happen to me.
Yeah.
And when I related these incidents to my my colleagues in the coffee room, we'd talk about it. And they'd say, well, you need to talk to the person before, you know, who lived there before you, and talk to them about what happened to them. And sure enough, their experiences were virtually the same. So we had the same house, same experience, different time, different individuals experiencing these things. And so I started writing them down and, you know, keeping notes of all the strange things that happened. And eventually it turned into a book. I published that in October of 1991. This is, you know, quite a time afterwards. It took me a collect the stories.
Yeah.
But within 2 weeks of the book coming out, I started getting phone calls, letters, faxes. This is before Twitter or tweet or anything like that. And these people were saying, you know, I've never had a paranormal experience in my life, but I came to Gettysburg last year, and here's what happened to me. And they would relate these things. And I literally got thousands of letters like that. So now we have 8 volumes.
I mean, that alone speaks volumes about how much these people, you know, when the first book came out, Mark, how much these people must have been moved by their experience to take the effort. Because, like, you know, as you refer to, this is pre-internet. So, you know, if you were going to write somebody a letter, you had to find out where they are and just basically do that. So did it take you aback at the time how much kind of instant feedback you were getting from readers?
Well, yeah, because, you know, it took me almost, well, a good 10 years and maybe 12 years to collect these stories and to put them all in one book. And then all of a sudden, virtually overnight, I'm getting letters from people who had an experience. I think the remarkable thing is they may have had an experience and they didn't want to talk about it. They didn't want to tell anybody because they were afraid of maybe being ridiculed or something. Or maybe they had been ridiculed when they did tell somebody, but all of a sudden they realized that they weren't the only ones that were having these experiences, that many, many, many other people over the years had anomalous experiences at Gettysburg. And so they felt a little more comfortable, I think, with sharing those.
Yeah, I think it's always important, because I've spoken to a couple of authors who, when they released a book, they had a very similar kind of response to it, Mark, and it always seems to surprise them that I think they work on what they've gathered, such as yourself, in regards to the stories you'd collated over that, you know, previous decade or so to pull those together, and then all of a sudden, like you say, within a few weeks and a month, they've near enough got their second volume ready to go, and it surprises them.
Yeah, it almost writes itself. You know, once you get the story, you know, the you get people over that hump that they are not going to be made fun of because I'm taking this seriously. Then all of a sudden they open up to you. So I think that's an interesting phenomenon. And also it speaks to how much activity, paranormal activity, there really is at Gettysburg.
Yeah. I mean, for a lot of people, they may not be fully aware of what Gettysburg means in America. Obviously, you know, it's for anybody with any knowledge or passing interest in the American Civil War, it's the key battle, really, I think, for a lot of people. And obviously over here in England, we had a similar, not to the extent. I mean, it's certainly not got the haunted reputation as Gettysburg has got, but we had a very similar battle at a place called Marston's Moor. And it had a very similar kind of body count, as it were. So for anybody who's not familiar with Gettysburg and how it ended up becoming what happened over those three or four days in July 1863, Mark, would you mind kind of just giving us a quick summary of how we got to this point in 1863?
Sure. Of course, it was about the battle took place about in the middle of the American Civil War. Civil War started in April of 1861 and ended in April of 1865. Hmm. Gettysburg was July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, 1863. So we're talking just about in the middle of the war. Hmm. It was the culmination of the second Confederate invasion of the North. Now, you know, you hear North against South, South being Confederates, North being the Union. And for the most part, the war was being fought in the South. Hmm. And the North basically were the aggressors trying to pull the Southern states back into the Union, and the Confederates were on the defense most of the time.
Yeah.
But there were two times when the Confederates invaded the North. One invasion ended at the Battle of Antietam or Sharpsburg in September of 1862. Mm-hmm. But within a few months, 9 months or eight or 9 months or so, they were ready to invade again. And actually, one of the reasons that they invaded is because the Confederates, the South, was on the verge of British recognition. Mm. They were getting close. I mean, the British actually were selling arms, those beautiful Enfield rifle muskets, selling arms, actually to both sides, to both the Union and the Confederates. So they're kind of hedging their bets there, who was going to win. But they were really leaning towards recognizing the Confederacy in the spring and early summer of 1863. So Robert E. Lee, the famous Confederate general, launched his invasion throughout the month of June. Neither commander wanted to fight at Gettysburg. The northern commander was ordered to stay between the invading Confederate army and Washington, D.C., which is, you know, south of Gettysburg, which is why you have Union Army, the Northern Army, coming in from the southern approach routes, and the Confederate Army coming in from the northern approach routes to Gettysburg. Yep. If you look at a map of Gettysburg, you'll see that it's about 10 or 11 roads all converge on the center square of town. And this is why the two armies bumped into each other accidentally in this area. The battle on the first day, July 1st, 1863, was literally a Confederate victory. The South had won on that first day, but they inadvertently drove the Union troops back from their positions northwest and east of town, drove them back into the town of Gettysburg, beyond the town, and to some very formidable heights to the south of Gettysburg, which, you know, echo now in history as, you know, Little Round Top, Cemetery Hill, Cemetery Ridge, Culp's Hill. You know, anyone studied the battle would be familiar with those.
Yeah.
Then the second day, Robert E. Lee decided he would have to attack that Union line. Mm. And he attacked on both ends of the line, trying to do the famous pincer movement.
Yeah.
But the Union line was, I mean, they were pretty heavy duty fortifications, and because they had all night to dig in the night of July 1st, and really good position. So Lee was unsuccessful on the second day. The third day, he decided to gamble and launch an assault into the center of the Union line, which comes down through history as the famous Pickett's Charge, which is synonymous with gallant failure. Mm. And that's exactly what happened. Is that he sent 12,500 men into the center, across a broad open field, into the center of the Union line, and two-thirds became casualties in just about 40 minutes of fighting. And that was the basically the last of the fighting, major fighting at Gettysburg, Lee realized his supplies were almost used up. Ammunition was very low, so he began a retreat the next 2 days in the pouring rain, withdrawing his troops from Gettysburg. Union Army followed him. The Confederates did fight a battle right there with their backs at the Potomac River before they could get across into Virginia. Hmm. But finally, they did get across. Sadly, the American Civil War did not end at Gettysburg. It lasted another 2 years until it finally ended in at Appomattox with Lee's surrender. And of course, the other famous thing I should say about Gettysburg is that as the carnage, 51,000 casualties, when they finally realized how much death and destruction had occurred there, they decided that they were going to put a national cemetery in at Gettysburg, which they began within a few weeks of the battle. And then on November 19th, 1863, just 4 months after the battle, Abraham Lincoln, the president of the United States, came to Gettysburg and delivered the Gettysburg Address and basically in 2 minutes rededicated the North to continuing the fight that the deceased Union soldiers had brought so far. Yeah. So, in a nutshell, that's Gettysburg. The key is the 51,000 casualties.
Yeah, I mean it's a staggering amount, Mark. For like you say, because the majority, as far as my understanding goes, the majority of the casualties were on that final day, and. I think is it over 7,000 men lost their lives at Gettysburg? There was 51,000 casualties, but of that, over 7,000 were fatally killed.
I think they figured about between 7,000 and 8,000 left dead on the battlefield, but that doesn't count the wounded that died within anywhere from a few hours after they were hit until maybe 2 weeks. Because the operations were crude, no antiseptics were known to exist then. I mean, they really didn't have anything. Lister and Pasteur didn't do their work until after the Civil War, and so a number of men who had suffered. I mean, all they knew how to do if you were shot in the arm or the leg is to amputate, because the mini ball 58 caliber soft lead would just pulverized the bone. And so that and the instruments were not sterilized, they were simply wiped off. And then the next person, so there were a lot of guys that died within 2 weeks of blood poisoning and tetanus and that type of thing.
I mean, plus as well, it's the height of summer, so it's probably the worst time to be wandering around somewhere with an open wound.
And when, the only shelter that was there, remember Gettysburg was like a farm town. Some of the fellows got some shelter in private homes or churches, but many of them were taken right out to the barn, which is, that had the nice soft straw on the floor, which of course the horses and the cattle just vacated, they just left them out. You know what they leave behind. So it was not very, very pleasant at all to be wounded and to be taken care of after the Battle of Gettysburg.
I think one of the most stunning statistics for me, Mark, of Gettysburg is that there was around 11,000-12,000 soldiers that are just classed as missing. Is that that they know they went there but they were never seen again, or that it was just certain casualties were just unrecognizable?
Well, you had several things. In fact, I worked at Gettysburg with a fella who his great-great-grandfather actually was a Confederate soldier and deserted at Gettysburg and just settled there, stayed north. And so that's part of it. Sometimes you have deserters, you guys just gave up and said, that's it, I'm done. Other guys that were buried and they, you know, buried perhaps by a farmer because their comrades had left.
Yeah.
And so some farmer buries two or three guys and puts a headboard up there, you know, one Confederate, two Confederate, because they didn't want to get too close to the bodies to identify them. The cows go out in the pasture. They knock over the headboards. It rains. The next year, it's all grass again. And the, you know, the farmer doesn't even know where, he can't even identify the grave sites anymore because it all looks the same. And then you also had the fellows who were attacking, say, artillery.
Yeah.
And there's a famous monument out there on the battlefield near Pickett's Charge called Double Canister at 10 Paces, which means the attacking troops would wait until they duck down or lie down until the cannon fired, and then they knew they had a few seconds, maybe 20 or 30 seconds before the guns were reloaded, that they could get up, and if they could rush them, they would be able to overwhelm the cannoneers. These guys got to within 10 paces, and canister is like a giant shotgun shell, and this was double canister. So these men were literally liquefied, and I mean, then what do you do? There's really nothing left, and so that's also part of your missing guys that. You know, their families would read about this horrific battle in Gettysburg, and the letters that were so faithfully written once a week just stopped coming, you know, to the family. And so then they knew something had happened, but that was it. That's the last they'd ever heard of their husband or son or brother.
Yeah. I mean, it is incredible. Like, as I've referred to a couple of times, I think it's simply staggering, really. Mark, what occurred, you know, for, on both sides, because, you know, the death toll and the destruction. I mean, even for the people that survived it, it must have been an horrific, if, you know, 72 hours to see the level of death and destruction all around you. It must have been horrendous for everybody that was there.
Absolutely. Yeah. The town was, you know, practically traumatized by it. I mean, we still... You know, it's Gettysburg still, and Gettysburgians still have a certain attitude, I guess, about around them that kind of tells you, look, this is a special place, and really not in a good way, you know, Gettysburg. You know, and even though now it's a, you know, there's obviously no, well, I shouldn't say there's no evidence of the battle. You can still find houses in Gettysburg with shells embedded in them, still with bullet marks. We run our tours out of a Civil War era house, and it's got a couple bullet holes in it that you can point to and look at. So it still is with us, and still they find periodically they'll find bodies. You know, something be heavy rain and a grave will wash open and. And they'll, of course, they're buried with much more ceremony now than they were right after the battle.
Yeah.
You know, but taken to the National Cemetery, and they even have a section for the Confederates now. They didn't bury Confederates right after the battle in the National Cemetery.
Yeah.
They were left out on the battlefield for another 6 or 7 years in unconsecrated graves, which may have something to do with why. With the hauntings, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't realize that as well. But I mean, to be fair, when you look back, you know, this is Northern Territory, and I would imagine any kind of concession, even looking back to what we would consider a merciful gesture, Mark, in regards to burying the Confederate soldiers, it just couldn't be done, I suppose, at that time.
Well, you're correct. Yeah, that a lot of times the Confederates were, you know, they were buried by either, you know, the men who stayed on the battlefield, which would have been the Union soldiers, and you know, these guys were just trying to kill your men. They were often buried in mass graves, such as Iverson's North Carolinians. Those men were buried kind of like just side by side and left buried on the battlefield, unembalmed, with nothing but a but their blanket for a casket until the 1870, say 1870, 71, before they were finally exhumed and sent south again.
Yeah.
But no, there were there. You know, they. I don't know. I guess they tried to do the best they can, but you know, when you have 7,000 or 8,000 on the battlefield to bury, often, for example, Mrs. Thorne, who was the wife of the caretaker for the Evergreen Cemetery, which is a citizen cemetery, she literally was 8.5 months pregnant and had to go out and dig graves to bury some of these soldiers. So, and obviously, it wasn't a pleasant duty because of the heat and the decomposition, but it had to be done. But they had to do it quickly. Not a lot of ceremony.
Absolutely. I mean, to be fair then, I mean, really, you could say that the area suffered two real emotional scenarios. Then you had the battle, and then I would imagine, I mean, because, I mean, it's, as you refer to there, it's incredibly unpleasant when you think about what the people had to do to remove the corpses that had been left, simply left behind, strewn everywhere. Was that, you know, 10 years later, somebody has to come and dig all these people back up. I mean, that alone would be a job I would not want to undertake for any money in the world, I think, Mark.
Well, that is correct. And the but of course, for 2 years, the war continued. So the Union took care of their dead and reburied them in the new National Cemetery there. But the Confederates, you know, nobody could even get to their bodies from their side. And there was a fellow who helped find as many bodies as he could. Samuel Weaver was his name. And I'm not sure. I think he got the bid because he was charging something like $1.59 or $1.69 a body to bring them all. And then in the early 1870s, finally the South, which was economically devastated by the Civil War, finally some ladies' literary societies or memorial societies got together and raised as much money as they could, or at least promised as much money as they could. Samuel Weaver had died by then, and his son, Rufus Weaver, took over and began, because he knew, you know, his father had also cataloged where the Confederate bodies were buried as well. They didn't dig them up, but they knew where they were. So he went out and started collecting these. And you see his accounts say on such and such a date, they shipped, you know, 101 bodies from Georgia. Well, when they say bodies, they, you know, after 6 or 7 years, 7 years in the ground, basically it was a skull and, you know, a couple of bones. But they knew they had 101 skulls, so they knew that they had 101 people. And so they sent these south on in big boxes, in trains, on trains. And that's how those Confederates eventually got home. But not, once again, as you've mentioned, not all of them left Gettysburg.
So, obviously, we've had these two enormous emotional experiences. We've had the battle, and then we've had the exhumation a few years later. When did the first kind of reports about strange things occurring start, Mark? Was it whilst the war was still going on, or was it sort of that post-war era that the first stories began to emerge about the Gettysburg battle?
Well, you had, you know, actually going into battle, strange things, paranormal things were happening. One of the very first stories that I ever collected about the battle of Gettysburg and ghosts, what happened the night of July 1st, 1863. And it was the, you know, the U.S. Army's 5th Corps marching in to Gettysburg from Hanover, Pennsylvania. It was a night march. They'd just gotten into camp. They were cooking their food, and all of a sudden they heard there's just been a battle. Pack up. We got to go. So they're on the road, and to Gettysburg. It's dark, and they can see, you know, the lights off in the distance of the farmhouses. all of a sudden this weird, eerie rumor came floating back through the column as they're marching along. And they said they're being led by a horseman, that they, you know, they'd start to catch up to him, and then he would ride ahead of them. Mm. But he was obviously leading them. And somebody got a glimpse of him, and the rumor came down the line that he had a tricorn hat on. He had a long cape. In other words, he had a uniform of a different war.
Yeah.
Of the Revolutionary War. Mm. And they, some people thought that they recognized George Washington, the famous commander, of course, of the American side of the Revolution, leading the troops into battle. That, of course, it's interesting because they forgot perhaps that he was not really victorious all the time against the British, we all know.
Yes.
And also that he was a Virginian. Now, here's a Virginian leading the Union Army. I don't know. I would be a little worried about that. Yeah. If I were a Union Northern soldier, yes, with a Virginian lead. But at any rate, that's the very first story that comes to us from that era. But I think another one which is very, very interesting is the Iverson's Pits I mentioned earlier. Mm. And that was a group of, on the first day's battle, a group of soldiers had commanded by Alfred Iverson from North Carolina, almost exclusively, marched out, kind of got themselves caught into in a open field, basically a trap. The Union troops stood up from behind a stone wall and fired into this group. Mm. And they said when they went out, I mean, and almost immediately, 100-150 went down. The rest of the men went down wounded or dead. The rest of the men tried to get into a gully there and were continuing to be fired on. And they finally, when the firing died down and the men retreated, when they went out to bury the dead, they said you could like look along their feet, and they were like in dress parade, all lined up. That's how quickly they died. Yeah. And so they buried him in a long trench, one or two long trenches, and the bodies then remained there. Once again, they were Confederates, so they were out there for a number of years until the 1870s when their bodies were exhumed. And the farmer who owned the land, his name was Forney, he couldn't get his men to work out there. They said they would come back with these really weird stories. They'd be working out there, and they would hear gunshots, or they would hear shouts, orders being shouted, bugles. Yeah. And the most frightening thing at all, they would hear screams of the wounded. They would not work out there. And so he gave up trying to make them work out there. And, you know, it's called Iverson's Pits now. You can't see the pits now, but for the longest time there was like a depression in the ground, and that's really one of the very first documentable ghost stories that I collected about Gettysburg.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, because there is one particular area of the battlefield which I think is known as Devil's Den,
right?
Which from reading your books and what I've read about, had a history that also predated the battle. Because it was supposed to have been the site of a legendary battle in Native American lore, which was, I think, was called the Battle of the Crows or something.
That is correct, Paul. Yes.
So there was already that kind of, because I think hadn't that area kind of garnered some kind of reputation as being somewhere you just didn't go. It was a bad place.
Yeah, of course, with that name, you know, yeah. Devil's Den, it's pretty descriptive. And you're right about the Battle of the Crows. That's what a local historian back in the 1880s thought he had discovered evidence of a battle, a great Native American battle. If you look on maps, because I've done a good bit of research on this online, you see that there was a separation between two major Native American tribes, And doggone it, if the line doesn't go almost right directly through where Gettysburg is, we're talking about a battle that is maybe 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. But I also, when I was a young ranger, I would, you know, be at someone at a party or something, and people would say, I want to show you my collection of bullets here that they picked up on the battlefield when they were kids. And they would show me a mason jar filled with bullets. And I'd see something next to it. I said, what's this? Because there was another jar filled almost at the top with arrowheads.
Wow.
So, and I'm counting twice as many arrowheads as bullets in this jar. The bullets take up more space. And I said, what about those? Oh, we just picked those up when we saw them. We just picked them up when we were looking for bullets. Well, it didn't dawn on me till later on. Maybe this is the evidence of a great Native American battle. I mean, certainly that's a lot of arrowheads for hunting. You know, you don't, you must be a pretty bad shot, you know, if you that many arrowheads, but I think they were probably, that's probably evidence of the Native American battle out there. And they said that it took place within a mile of Devil's Den and Big Round Top and Little Round Top. So that would put it all in the, in the area of the battlefield. But Devil's Den is definitely, you know, I have a couple ghost stories from there pre-battle, but also many, you know, when people ask me all the time, they'll say, where's the most haunted place on the battlefield? And I have to kind of equivocate a little bit and say, well, you know, it changes from year to year out here. That Spangler Spring has a lot of activity one year and then someplace else, but consistently, Devil's Den is one of the most active places, and right next to it is a place called the Triangular Field. That is also very, very active, and people can go there almost any time and get everything from weird photographs to EVP, which is the electronic voice phenomenon, which I've got lots of out there. So that Devil's Den is definitely was named correctly. I mean, it does have an eerie, weird feeling about it, and it it looks bad, you know. It's huge boulders of granite and little caves that you can walk through, and huge boulders that are teetering over your head. But it would, and it would not have been a good place to fight, because you know, you go walking around a boulder, and all of a sudden you're confronted with an enemy with a bayonet. So it's not a good place.
So, I mean, once the story started getting out, was that sort of around when it started to sort of gain some traction, Mark? Was that kind of sort of from the 1870s onwards?
I, you know, locally, yes, it was, you know, people would talk about things, that happened out on the battlefield that they couldn't really explain, for example. But it was mostly locals that would talk about it. And there wasn't a lot of, obviously, other than the local Gettysburg newspaper, a lot of social networking or anything like that. But for example, there would be the stories of the at Devil's Den of a couple of hunters that got out there, and they were kind of lost, and it was getting dark and cold because it was close to wintertime. And they looked up and they saw a fellow motioning to them to follow him, to get him out. And so they started following him, and they got kind of close to him, and they realized that he was Native American, and they hadn't been in that area in 1,000 years. So they finally got close to him, and he just kind of vanished. And but they were thankful for him, because he led him to a place that they recognized and could get out and get home. But those kind of stories, you know, didn't have they were just passed around through the town. Did you hear about such and such out there? They saw a ghost. But until probably the 1990s, when I started, because I remember going to Gettysburg and asking, when I was younger, in my teens, asking the local lifeguard, you know, that I met at the pool, you know, who was about my age, are there any ghost stories about Gettysburg? And they're like, not really. I haven't heard any. So it took a while to collect all the stories, and then of course once they got out into the general public, I realized how many more people had experienced things.
Yeah, I mean, was it some in regards to visitors coming to the area, Mark? When was it designated, because it obviously became a national park, I would imagine, for numerous reasons, but were people visiting the park sort of at the turn of the last century, or was that something that's kind of become a more modern phenomena as well?
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.
Well, I think you had a couple of waves, I guess you'd call it, of tourism. And actually, the very first wave occurred a day or two after the battle ended. Mm. And that would have been the individuals who had heard about this huge battle that the Army of Northern Virginia, which was the Southern Army, and the Army of the Potomac had fought at Gettysburg. And you realized, you know, my brother or husband or son was in the Army of the Potomac. I wonder if he's all right. And they would travel from Pennsylvania to Gettysburg to try and find any evidence of their relative. Mm. And sadly, maybe even find him desperately wounded and maybe dying. Mm. And so that was your first wave of, I guess you call them tourists.
Yeah.
But they were relatives trying to find their relatives. Mm. But then it seemed like after the war, the soldiers themselves started returning to Gettysburg on the 25th anniversary, the 50th, 75th anniversary, all the way up until 1938, which was the 75th anniversary. The men were in their 90s, the ones that came. There were only a couple thousand left.
Yeah.
But that was another wave of tourism that was coming to Gettysburg. But once again, it really didn't get a whole, other than through historians and history teachers, didn't get a whole lot of notoriety until I think that 1938 reunion, because that was about the time Franklin D. Roosevelt came to Gettysburg, dedicated the Peace Lake Memorial. Hmm. And that was about the time when you had radio and mass media.
Yeah.
So that's when it really started getting in the general public. And I think then also right after World War II, that's when we really, you know, the soldiers came home. They're happy to be alive. Mm. And everybody suddenly could start to get a good job because there was a good economy after the war.
Yeah.
They had cars, and all of a sudden they realized, hey, you know, you don't have to be a Vanderbilt or a Rockefeller to take a vacation, to go someplace. And that's, I think, when people started visiting Gettysburg as part of their heritage.
Yeah.
And then it continued all the way through to now. Yeah. We have a large visitation. Mm.
So when did it become a national park then, Mark? Was it something that happened immediately after the war, or after the towards the end of that century, or is that a fairly modern occurrence as well?
Actually, there were organizations, the Gettysburg Battlefield Memorial Association, which almost right after the battle started buying up specific pieces of property. Mm. That were battlefield, that had been battlefield. So that movement actually started almost right after the battle. Mm. Because they realized this was an important moment in American history, and they had to preserve this property. And then gradually more and more was purchased. Eventually the War Department got involved.
Yeah.
The United States government got involved in terms of the War Department. They purchased more, started putting up monuments and plaques and descriptive plaques of the battle, what happened there, who was there, that type of thing. And then in I think it was the 1930s, is when the National Park Service took over. And, of course, then it was a great renaissance in the 1960s, because that was, you know, actually slightly before that, because 1961 was the centennial of the American Civil War. And so there was a lot of money put into the various national parks, the national battlefields, and a lot of new visitor centers and new roads were put in. So that was when that all occurred.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing I've noticed about this is that I think as an area of paranormal activity, probably one of the biggest I've come across, Mark, because the battlefield essentially encompassed the whole town. So near enough every kind of part of that area seems to have been seared with this emotional imprint of that battle and the ramifications of it. So is it unusual, would you say, for a location to have so many well-known haunted portions to it?
You ask if it's unusual, and it's not unusual to me. You know, I've been into this thing.
Yeah.
And I wrote another book, as a matter of fact, called Civil War Ghost Trails, where I had a chance to go to all the major Civil War battlefields, collect their ghost stories, and I could compare them with Gettysburg and some of the other battles. And I think I would have to say that the battlefields, I did a pretty comprehensive study of Gettysburg over 30 years. And I think if you had someone doing the same thing with some of the other not as famous battlefields, Chattanooga, Chickamauga, Kennesaw Mountain, I bet you would find that there are a lot more ghost stories out there than there are recorded yet, because it just takes a matter of collecting and verifying these stories. And you would find that they probably have a lot, but my personal experience, we had now they do differ. We had ghost tours down in Fredericksburg, Virginia, for a number of years. So I did some research down there and collected a number of stories. And the difference between Gettysburg stories, which I have close to 1,000 of, and the Fredericksburg stories, which I heard probably 200 or so, the difference is in the type of haunting. Now, in my Gettysburg stories, only about 10% of those stories are visuals.
Yeah.
60-some percent are auditory. You'll hear a ghost before you see a ghost in Gettysburg. In Fredericksburg, and this may have to do with the way they collect the stories, I don't know, but a good 25% were visuals.
Yeah.
So in other words, in Fredericksburg, you're going to see a ghost rather than, you know, and you'll still hear them, but you'll see them two and a half times the rate that you would at Gettysburg.
Yeah.
And I wondered what that was from, and it could very well be just a simple matter of the fact that the Rappahannock River, very large river, flows almost right next to Fredericksburg, right up to the streets almost, you know. And, of course, water has incredible energy associated with it, you know, just the physical energy of these, you know, thousands of pounds per cubic yard moving.
Yeah.
It's a lot of energy. And I think the theory is that ghosts when we're in spirit form, somehow we need to borrow energy, because you really don't have any when you don't have lunch or dinner or anything like that when you're a ghost.
Yeah.
You have to borrow energy to manifest. And I think that may be one of the sources, because one of the most haunted places in Gettysburg, as well as Devil's Den, which has water flowing right through it, would be Sachs Bridge, which is out, spans Marsh Creek, which is the largest body of water in the area, and that is notoriously haunted. So I think that, you know, that's just my theory, that when you have a lot more energy you have the and plus the history of the of death and agony and emotional turmoil that occurred in Gettysburg, you certainly have the perfect storm for creating ghosts.
Yeah. I mean it's such an area with a rich history. And I've always been fascinated. One of my favorite Gettysburg stories is about, I believe there were two admin staff who got in a lift. And I believe they descended downstairs and came across a scene as though they'd walked into a film, and then but there was no noise. And I think, did they just step back in the lift and go on to a different floor because they thought they'd come out somewhere wrong? Or
they didn't even get out of the elevator.
I don't blame them, to be fair.
No, I mean, and it was horrific. I mean, they had the doors open and they looked into a hospital, a Civil War hospital scene with blood all over the place, an individual standing there ready to operate on somebody, people moving in the corners as if they couldn't, you know, really get up or anything because they were wounded. Now, the interesting thing about that story, Paul, is that I knew those two, the two women, the two administrators that happened to.
Yeah.
I interviewed, they went immediately after they came up from the basement, they ran over to the security office at, this is at Gettysburg College. Yeah. And the building that they had been in, that the administration building is in now, historically was a hospital at the time of the battle. So they went over to security and reported this, and the security officer was excited. He thought, aha, I'm going to catch one of those pesky fraternities who broke into the place and messed it all up. I'll get them. So within a minute or two, they were back over and went down, and it was all gone. It was pristine. And I interviewed him, and he said, oh, yeah. So they were scared. They were scared to death, and, you know, they wouldn't have come to get me if it hadn't happened. And the interesting part is, years later, I was doing an autographing session, my books, in the Gettysburg College bookstore. And a couple came up to me and they said, we know that woman that happened to. I said, oh, you know such and such. And they're like, no. So you must know the other one. No. I said, wait a minute. Talk to me a little bit here. What's going on? They gave me the name of a third individual, not even – associated, wasn't excuse me, wasn't the same time or anything. Yeah. It was roughly the same decade. It was 1980s, but they said she was actually with a accounting firm that was doing an audit of Gettysburg College. They were up on the top floor and they asked her to go downstairs into the to get to the cars and bring some paperwork up. She got on the elevator. It went past the first floor down into the basement, doors open. I actually called her and interviewed her. She had moved out to Denver. I don't think because of that, but she moved out to Denver. And she described exactly the same scene that these two other women had described. And yet it was a different person altogether. Just a couple of weeks ago, I talked to some people who were alumni from Gettysburg College, yeah, back in the 1980s. And this one woman told me about a friend of hers, a student who had done the same thing, who'd gotten on that all of it. So there's three different stories that I still have to track down this other one, but there are three different times when this elevator malfunctioned and took these individuals basically down to a hell on earth, which is what you could easily describe a Civil War hospital as.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, the thing that strikes me about the two ladies that had that experience was the notable thing about their experience was they said it was silent.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the same in the other two that you've come across, Mark? Do they remember? Because I would imagine it's an assault on the senses when you see something like that.
Yeah, they did not mention whether it was silent or not. So the one I didn't interview, but the one that I did interview, she didn't say anything about any noises or anything. But they definitely described a hospital scene to a T.
Yeah.
I mean, as far as they could perceive it. I mean, your brain has got to be going crazy when you're on an elevator, the doors open, and you see something like that where it's not supposed to be. So I don't know how perceptive or other than just being seared on your memory, what details you would pick up. But what they described was pretty horrific.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very unusual experience to have because, you know, in the history of hauntings across the world, it's very rare that if someone has an encounter with a ghostly scene, it's very rare that it's something as traumatic and as violent as that as well, Mark. It's unusual in its severity, if you understand my meaning.
Yes. Yeah, and it was, I guess you'd have to call it a residual haunting, you know, because it's like it just replays itself over and over and over again, like a DVD or, you know, and that is a hallmark of that type of haunting, and it's in the same place,
yeah,
all the time. So, although other things have been seen on the battlefield, it seems like there are also periods, not necessarily places, but time periods where some paranormalists call them warps.
Yeah.
In other words, a split in the fabric of time, like a curtain is pulled aside. Mm. And you can look in to the past, yeah, and see things as they were. It doesn't last long, maybe seconds, because, for example, I have probably half a dozen accounts of what I've called the Phantom Regiment or the Phantom Battalion.
Yeah.
And people will it's almost always in the same place, which is a battle area called the Wheatfield, which was, you know, trampled down and changed hands 3 or 4 times, and 2,000-3,000 casualties left just in that one area. Hmm. But the description is always the same. People, and this goes back to before I was a park ranger, where the very first story I heard were some dignitaries up on Little Round Top looked down into the valley there, and they saw this unit of soldiers marching around, doing maneuvers, and then marching back into the woods. And so they thought they were really special because, yeah, the Park Service had put this on for them, but the Park Service didn't know anything about it. But the most recent was a woman, her son, and the family dog, which is really kind of important that point, because they had gotten onto the battlefield about 6 in the morning, and they looked down and they saw what they thought was a reenactor unit marching around in the wheat field, maneuvering back and forth. The dog in the back seat was growling. So the dog saw it too. It's not like these two people were hallucinating. The dog saw it. And then all of a sudden, a couple of joggers came over the hill and the whole unit just vanished, just disappeared before their eyes. And the dog, you know, stopped growling and went back to sleep. So the Phantom Battalion or Phantom Regiment is one of those residual hauntings that seems to just show up. There's a rip in the fabric of time and people get a glimpse at this for how many ever seconds or minutes they're privileged to see this, and then it disappears.
Yeah, I suppose it's, especially in that example there, Mark, it's a bit like you get absorbed in some kind of bubble of a different kind of reality, and the joggers kind of punctured that bubble and brought them back to where they should have been.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. And the fact that the animal was having a reaction clearly suggests, because obviously anybody that's got an interest in the paranormal will know, you know, dogs and cats tend to stare at things, and it's quite a peculiar experience. I used to live in a house and one of our dogs would just bark at a spot. up halfway up the wall for no reason.
Oh wow, yeah. I have accounts of that. That happens, yeah. As you know from personal experience.
Yeah.
That is an important part of that story, that the dog actually, you know, so because so many people like to say when they try and debunk these things, they're like, well, it was just these two people. It was a mass hallucination of two people, you know, seeing this thing, mm-hmm. convincing each other that they've seen this. But nobody convinced the dog. The dog, you know, they're just observers. They just alert. Mm-hmm. You know, he was like, do I have to defend my humans from my people from this? And then when it disappeared, he realized, oh no, we're okay.
I mean, it is really interesting as well, because like you say, I mean, as we referred to, the chances of a sighting at Gettysburg are probably not as high as some other areas and locations in the States, but both of those scenarios are extremely vivid experiences. So, you know, if you want to talk about a sighting, I suppose you probably couldn't ask for a better example.
No, I agree. That would pretty much, if I were a tourist on vacation and I saw a Phantom Regiment disappear before my very eyes, that would pretty much put the icing on the cake for that vacation.
Absolutely, because I know there's some very well documented experience in Gettysburg. I mean, there's the Lonely Soldier is well known.
I know that there was an account of and this actually happened to the daughter of a superintendent who was home alone, and that she lived in the Cadore house. Now the Cadore house is right smack in the center of the field of Pickett's Charge.
Yeah.
And so it's about 3/4 mile out of town, all dark. And the horror that occurred around that house is indescribable, because, you know, that's once again not 100 yards from where that double canister at 10 paces occurred. And she was home one night, and her parents were in town at some sort of function, and they had fixed up the basement for a study area for her, because she was in college at the time.
Yeah.
And she was working, and it was quiet. All of a sudden, she heard footsteps above her head walking around on the first floor.
Yeah.
And so she called up the stairs. She said, Daddy, is that you? No answer. So she realized that there might be a prowler, and she heard the footsteps go to the stairs up to the second floor and go up to the second floor. So this is before cell phones. So she ran up to the first floor, grabbed the telephone, called the emergency number and for the Rangers. And of course, when the superintendent's daughter calls, they get out there pretty quickly. And so she was talking to them, and all of a sudden she heard the footsteps coming down from the second floor. So I've got to go. She hung up and she ran back down into the cellar and continued to hear these footsteps wandering around, going to the windows, seemingly looking out the windows and that type of thing. Yeah. And all of a sudden she started hearing footsteps coming towards the door to the basement. Mm-hmm. And she thought she heard the first footstep on the first step, and then all of a sudden she heard the chief ranger call down, you know, Annie, are you all right? She came running upstairs. She said, Bill, did you catch him? He was right here. She said, no, I didn't see anybody. She said, well, I was hearing him walking around. He came right where you're standing now. Maybe ran out the back. Just then two other rangers came in from the back, because he had, you know, put them outside to catch anybody jumping out the window or something. And so it remained a mystery, but pretty frightening thing when you're a young lady and, you know, you think it's a prowler, and then you find out, nothing to worry about. It's just a ghost.
Well, it's the lesser of two evils, I would suggest, Mark, really.
I
think that would be I think that would be a scary experience for anybody, regardless.
Correct.
When you know you're home alone and you you know, any noise, if you're home alone and you're relaxing, watching television or reading or whatever, if you hear an unexpected noise from somewhere in the house, you're on high alert regardless.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, one of the other notable locations is Rose Farm. Now, I think, was that used as a field hospital?
The Rose Farm, yes. Yeah, and it became one of the largest burial sites in the area. In fact, some of the photographs that you see, the old photographs of the dead bodies were taken out on the Rose Farm, near the Rose Farm. And that was, it was a field hospital, and the casualties there were pretty horrific as well.
Yeah. So is that, I mean, this is the good thing about Gettysburg, I think, is that there is such a variety of hauntings in the location. So what do people, what's the general experience at Rose Farm?
That, there's been a number, I think, one of them, of course, is the Phantom Regiment. That's out near the wheat field.
Yeah.
But also, there was an interesting thing that actually historically happened out there. There was a, I think there are three or four daughters that were out there at the Rose Farm. And, of course, these are, you know, other than seeing, you know, calves being born and colts being born, things like that, the violence and bloodshed and things like that is virtually unknown. But once that became a field hospital, there was an awful lot of that stuff going on, and the young ladies were their senses were assaulted by horrifying sights. And when the men were all gone months after the battle, there was one young lady in particular, one of the Rose girls, and we have the account of one of the day book from one of the doctors in town, that one year he had to go out and treat this young lady numerous times because for things like she would see on the whitewashed wall, she would see blood coming through the walls.
Mm.
Oh. Yeah, this is obviously a hallucination, a mental aberration that she, from the trauma that she experienced. And one final account was that he had to restrain her, I believe in kind of a straitjacket type thing, and take her into town, remove her. Yeah. So that was, you know, a real horrible thing that happened. It had I guess it did have to do with ghosts, you know, ghostly things that happened to her. We don't know exactly what they were, but certainly things that happened because of the battle on the Rose Farm there.
Dear me. I mean, there is that psychological trauma as well for everybody that remained in the area after what had happened as well, Mark. Okay. So I'm sure there would be several stories as sad as that, really, because, you know, essentially there was a lot of people there probably suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, we didn't call it that then, but yes.
Shell shock, as it became known.
Shell shock, yeah.
So over the years, Mark, what's your favourite story someone's told you about Gettysburg or your favorite personal experience?
Well, one of the strangest things that ever happened to me, and in this field you get a lot of strange things to happen, but I was there's a farm not too far out of town. It was used as a Confederate field hospital called the Daniel Lady Farm. Mm-hmm. And your life is so, When armies come in to fight a battle, your life is completely, if you're a civilian, blown to pieces, because they basically took over Mrs. Lady's front room, her because it has southern exposure and lots of light, as the operating room. And to this day, you can see bloodstains on the floor that poor Mrs. Lady probably tried for years with the harshest soap she could to get up off the wood floor, and they just wouldn't, you know, she couldn't get them out, because you can actually even see a handprint you know, of blood, four fingers and a thumb, where somebody said, okay, son, it's your turn, put a bloody handprint down and got up. So, you know, fast forward to the present. It was purchased by the Gettysburg Battlefield Preservation Association, the nonprofit. I was on the board of directors for a number of years. And they restored it to it what it looked like at the time of the battle. And one day I got a phone call from the caretaker out there. And he not only took care of the house and guarded it and watched it, but he also worked out on the field. And he said, Mark, if you want to see a paranormal experience before your eyes, come on out to the lady farm right now. How can I pass that up, Paul, right?
Absolutely.
I threw my gear in the van and went out. And I had my video recorder going when I walked up to the door, and he opened the door. I said, what's up? He said, I'm not going to say anything. I just want you to know that this place was cleaned up, a spick and span yesterday, because we had groups in that were going to, you know. But, and he opened the door to that front room, and I walked in, and I looked down on the floor. And there were streams of a rust-colored liquid, probably 5-6 feet long, 3 or 4 of them. There were droplets of this liquid with looked like it was crystallizing in the droplets. There was like a clear serum that seemed to be separating itself from that. Yeah. And I'm videotaping all this, and I'm like, and I looked up at the ceiling, and it was whitewashed. I said, did a pipe break in the basement? You know, I thought it was rusty water. And he said, nope, this just appeared like this. And so I got a yardstick, and I took photos of that. And then I said, do you have a tissue? And he said, yeah. So I dipped it in the liquid, and I didn't know what I was going to do with that. But I took it. I said, well, I don't know. I've documented this. I don't know what to do. He said, well, I got to get out. Well, I got stuff to take care of out there. So I don't know what I'm going to do. Yeah. So he leaves. And so I go back and to my apartment, and all of a sudden, about 2 hours later, I get a phone call, and it's him. I said, what's up? He said, it's gone. I said, what? What are you talking about? He said, the liquid is gone. I said, okay. So jump back in my car, back out, and I'm videotaping once again, and walk in, and I videotape the floor, and there's absolutely nothing there. It's dry. And he bends down, and you can see him in the video touching the area. He says, right here, wasn't it? I said, yeah. And he picks his hand up, and he's got dust on his fingertips. He said, what the heck is this? I said, I have no idea. And my wife, Carol, was there. She said, well, I wonder what this, if you still have the sample that you took. So she runs out to the van, and she says, it's still there. We still have the sample. I said, okay. So the GBPA is fairly well connected with lawyers and politicians and law enforcement. So they sent the sample off to a forensics lab.
Yeah.
They did tests on it. 3 weeks later, results came back. The liquid was blood, and the species was human.
Oh.
All this blood, all this human blood there, and it literally vanished. I mean, there were blood stains from 155 years before that you couldn't get up off the floor. Here, this stuff just vanished. No stains, no liquid, no. It was like I was in a time warp, you know? Yeah. It was like all of a sudden it's completely dry and dusty, and I don't know what happened. I really don't. To this day, I can't explain any of that. But it's all on tape, and it all has the date stamps and time stamps and everything on it.
Yeah. Has that ever repeated itself, Mark?
Not that I know of. Yeah. Not that I know of. I haven't heard any more about that.
Yeah. I mean, there is another striking thing about Gettysburg is that there is a large number of reports that seem to be quite unique to the witness, where they tend to have an experience that perhaps isn't shared by others.
Yeah, to some extent, we have that, and we also have the situations where the same thing happens, you know, same event happens to different individuals, at a different time in the same venue. So you have both the unique things that occur and also the reoccurring things that happen time and time again to different people.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the chapters in my in Ghosts of Gettysburg 8, I call it deja vu, because I started realizing here almost 20 years later that in the same buildings, in the same sites, the same things are happening to a whole new generation of people, which is, I think, about as close as you can get, you know, to doing a scientific study of this, because one of the tenets of this scientific method is to have a repeatable experiment.
Yeah.
And of course, with ghosts, you can't order them around. And, but when you document things that are the same and they happen over and over and over again, I think that's about as close as you can get to any kind of scientific method that you, when you're studying the paranormal.
Yeah. So obviously, as we wind things up a little bit, Mark, in regards to, I was looking at the website recently, and I noticed the length that you can do the ghost tours on is an incredible amount of time. I think, is it 8 or 9 months of the year that they run the different ghost tours around the area?
Yeah, we can. We start in early spring, in March, and then run tours. You know, we don't do them every night, but except in the summertime when it's really, really busy. But we'll actually run tours through November, through Thanksgiving weekend. Believe it or not, that's a busy weekend for us.
Wow.
Then it gets kind of quiet in Gettysburg between the tourists, and I don't think the ghosts get any more quiet. I think they're still out there, but we don't have anybody to see them, you know, in town in Gettysburg. So
yeah, I mean, there is a wide variety as well, because I think you do 3 or 4 different tours that are completely separate entities to each other.
Yeah, right now we have 4 tours that we can put on. There's a college campus tour, there's a Baltimore Street tour, there's the Gettysburg West tour, which is a Confederate battle line, and then the Steinway Avenue tour, which is Pickett's Charge. At one time, we had a ghost train. We hooked up with the local railroad and ran a ghost train where we put a guide on there to tell stories. We did a seminary ridge tour. So we have had quite a few number of tours over the years.
Yeah. I think what made me chuckle as well was in your FAQs on the website where one of them was, "Will I see a ghost?" Which really made me chuckle.
Well, we get that a lot, you know, And, you know, the only thing we can say is, you know, it's kind of up to the ghost.
Yeah.
You know, if they want to show themselves to you, then you'll be lucky or unlucky.
Yeah.
And get a vision, but you know, they don't perform on command.
sadly.
Yeah. Oh. We charge a lot more for our tours if we could get.
I'm not surprised. I don't blame you, Mark. So, like I said, thank you very much for your time today. It's been a real pleasure to get a bit more insight into Gettysburg, because obviously, on this side of the pond, it's probably doesn't get the scrutiny that it does over your side for obvious reasons, Mark. So thank you very much for taking for a trip around one of the most haunted battlefields in the world, I would suggest.
Paul, it's been my pleasure. Thanks very much.
Hey, you're very welcome. Where can everybody keep up to date with your work and find your books, Mark?
At our website, ghostsofgettysburg.com. And it's plural, Ghosts of Gettysburg, because there is another one out there that's not, but it's ghostsofgettysburg.com.
Absolutely. And how many volumes are you up to now?
8 volumes, and I'm working on a 9th. And I have other books, too, that are associated with the ghost paranormal phenomenon, like Civil War Ghost Trails and Cursed in Virginia and Cursed in Pennsylvania. So there's a lot of them on the same topic, generally, of paranormal.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time and your trouble today. It's really enlightening and a little chilling. So thank you for that. And I wish you continued success with the tours and the best of time for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.